Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. Right now on this day, the 31st of October, the end of the month, back in 1926, there was a failed assassination attempt on the new Prime Minister of Italy at the time, who had been elected in 1922. That was Benito Mussolini. The failed assassination attempt came by way of a young 15-year-old who would then later be lynched on the spot. 1941 on this day, Mount Rushmore would be completed. In 1984 on this day, Indira Gandhi would be assassinated by her bodyguards at her home in New Delhi, and her son Rajiv would take over as the Prime Minister of India. A very interesting time in history. In 1992 on this day, the Roman Catholic Church would apologize to Galileo Galilei for the way they treated him only 359 years later. Guess it's better late than never, right? In 1994 on this day, Venus Williams would make her professional tennis debut at the age of 14, beating world number 58 on that day. In 1999 on this day, Mika Hakkinen would win his second ever Drivers' Championship. And in 2022 on this day, a lady by the name of Taylor Swift would make music history by becoming the only artist, or the first artist rather, in history to have all 10 of the top spots on the US Billboard Hot 100 with her album Midnights. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at Renergen results. They gave us interim update for their first half of the year ended August 2024. We chat to Stefano Morani, the CEO, around the performance of the business and what it means going forward. Then we have a conversation with the team at 27Four around the new Diversity, Equity and Inclusion Index that they've put together that suggests that asset management firms in South Africa are still largely under-transformed and have needs for increasing inclusion. Then we have a conversation with the team at Trend Micro around the phenomenon of having our mobile phones hacked. We couldn't do a consumer segment yesterday because of the budget, so we're going to do it today. We're going to take a look at everything you need to know and how to protect yourself and what you can look out for. Then, because it's Thursday, we've got an SME of the week to get through. We're going to be speaking to the founder of XTLS Dreadlocks, a company based out in KZN, about what they're doing in the hair space.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We kick off with how the markets have been moving throughout the day, and I'm joined on the line to take a look at today's market movements by wealth manager at PSG Wealth, Nellis Brink. Good evening, Nellis. Lovely to speak to you. Markets today had a very weird kind of day. It looks as though we just got a bit of a sell-off towards the end of the month, not just locally, but across the board with international markets as well.
Thank you, Jimmy. Appreciate the opportunity. Yes, definitely a bit of a red day on the markets. We've seen a 1.58% movement on the JSE. That's a downward movement, obviously, and of course, led by resources, 3.8% down. But it's definitely, as you said, a bit of a risk-off trade globally. The two main drivers, we believe, behind it is a bit of disappointing inflation data that came through from the EU, printing at just above 2% with an expectation of below 2%. And then secondly, of course, we see a lot of traders taking some money off the table with the US election around the corner.
That seems to be the most sensible thing to do. I mean, we are absolutely certain we're going to get a new president in the United States, no matter how the election turns out. But taking some money off the table does kind of make a bit of sense. Nellis, do you think that investors are worried that the outcome of the presidential race might not be as expected or as clear cut? I mean, both candidates have been running dangerously close to one another as we've drawn closer to this time.
Absolutely. I think it's a big fear because it's two very different candidates, especially their feelings towards South Africa and Africa. The polls, I don't think, is a very good guidance because we've got a very technical US election system, and not to delve into that, I'm going to take all of your time, but the basics of it is that the president or the candidate with the most votes will not necessarily become the next president. And then the whole fight in 2020 around the stolen election, that's something that's feelings that's surfacing again can we trust the electronic voting systems and all of that? So definitely quite a bit of uncertainty globally.
Nellis, you brought up the CPI print in Europe, and I wonder, does that print concern markets at the moment? I mean, we've seen obviously the inflation conversation being around sticky inflation and all of that, but we've really kind of shifted to a more, okay, we've peaked on inflation, central banks are starting to cut. Is the world actually really concerned about what's happening with European inflation, or does it mainly concern European countries?
You've hit it on the number. The world thinks we are done. We've gone as far as most of the global rates have been reached. We are below 4. The US is sitting at 2.1 as expected. We've already started the rate cut cycle, and now we get a hot print from the EU. So it's just a bit of a, I think startled is rather the word than scared. Maybe it's not as easy to get rid of the inflation as we thought.
Well, we did expect that some of the inflation would inherently just end up being absorbed into the new way of doing things. I suppose that's one of those things where not all the inflation ever really does go away. And I guess that's where people start to be concerned. Speaking of data that's come out, the US gave us their personal consumption expenditure index, and that data is usually a preferred measure by central bank chair Jerome Powell to take a look at just what's happening with the US consumer. Did that data surprise the way the EU CPI data did?
Luckily not. It came in on the number exactly as we expected. So it seems their current status quo is working. But do remember, Jerome is sitting in that hot seat after the president-elect has been announced. That's his next meeting. Now, if we see a Kamala win or a Harris win, he won't be as pressured to cut big, where Trump made it very clear if he doesn't cut big and drastic, he's out of a job.
So that's an interesting spanner in the works. The fact that the US Fed in its entirety could be up in the air with the US elections. Very interesting take. I mean, I wonder from Donald Trump's perspective, and something you mentioned a little earlier, Nellis, around the fact that even if you get the most votes, it doesn't necessarily mean that you are going to be president. I think back to Donald Trump's first run-in as the president. Hillary Clinton actually got more votes in that particular election, but she didn't get the right votes. Does this now mean that Donald Trump, I mean, coming back for a second term, is he more dangerous now than he was in the first term? I mean, we've had a lot of guys say, look, he's not that bad. We've done it before. But you think about Donald Trump and you realize that he would then not be eligible for a third term. And this could be the final hurrah from him, so to speak.
Of course. I think he'll be better at it than he was the first time around for the simple reason. I think he's been through it. He knows what needs to be done. But once again, the US politics does not allow for any one person to come in and make sweeping reforms for the simple reason the House or the Senate will block it. I don't think, and this is pure speculation, but I don't think we'll see what they call a clean sweep where the Republicans take the House, the Senate, and Trump gets announced as president. Because then it becomes possible. But still, not even all of the Republicans votes for Trump. So a bit of a tricky space.
Certainly some interesting developments there. We're going to have to keep an eye on them for next week's elections. Nellis, I want to take a look at some local developments. We got some updates from Oceana and AB InBev. Interesting numbers from a production point of view with AB InBev. Let's start with them.
AB InBev, very disappointing. Obviously, we thought as much with their midterm announcement. We already saw them dropping off a bit on total volume. And then with their announcement today, their total volume is down by 1.3%. And it seems like a small number. But I mean, for a company that produces the amount of drinks that they do, 1.3 is a massive decline in total volume. So quite disappointing. Share moving downwards by 6.38% today. Primarily driven by two things that we could see. There was a big boycott against Bud Light in the US, and that's now pulling through the numbers. And then secondly, we had very big floods in China, and that greatly affected the sales in China. And I think the Chinese economy has not really recovered to the extent where we want them to be. So they are definitely consuming slower.
The perils of having an international business. Things around the world can affect your business. Let's look at Oceania before we wrap things up, Nellis. The voluntary update on their year ended September 2024. Obviously, we will get a bit more color around the numbers once everything's been reviewed and finalized. But the update shedding some light on what we can expect earnings per share and headline earnings per share to look like.
So the voluntary update, I think, is a very, it's a purely technical thing. I think it's very prudent from the directors to launch the voluntary update. And they simply said, remember, we are going to see a drastic decrease in earnings per share because we sold off a big company last year, Commercial Cold Storage Logistics, or CCS in short, that puffed the earnings per share by more than 300 cents. So if we see a decrease in 300 cents, it's not necessarily a negative movement. So if we normalize the earnings per share, they still estimate a 15 to 17% growth year on year, which is excellent. I mean, it's a tough space to be in. We're seeing declining global fish stocks. We're seeing the environmentalists pulling in on global fishing. I think a 15 to 18% increase in earnings per share would be stunning. And it's just be mindful, it's going to be significantly less than the 1,094 of last year because of the sale of that underlying company.
Well, we'll have to wait and see how these numbers actually pan out when they are released. We'll discuss those with the relevant parties when that time does come. Nellis, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Wonderful chatting to you. Nellis Brink, Wealth Manager at PSG Wealth, on some of the market movements throughout the day and what could potentially explain what happened on today's markets.
Imagine if you could save time like you save money. A second here, a minute there. Type a little faster, walk a little faster. Or you could stop scrolling on the internet. Just think of all the hours you'll save. Now what if you could take all that time and invest it? Watch it grow. Until eventually, one day, you'd have so much time that you wouldn't know what to do with it all. But unfortunately, time doesn't work like that. It can't be stored or banked. And unlike money, you can't make it back. That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do whatever you want to do, even if it is scrolling on the internet. Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Renergen Limited, a company that specializes in liquefied natural gas, that's LNG production, as well as helium, gave us an update for their 6 months ended August 2024. Joined on the line by the Renergen CEO, Stefano Morani, to take a look at the company's performance, try and make sense of how they are faring in the first half of their year. Good evening, Stefano. It's been a while. Lovely to speak to you. Looking at the numbers, revenue up 1.8 million. The rest of the numbers not looking so good. How do you reflect on the first half of the period?
Good evening to you and the listeners, and thanks for having me. First and foremost, what's necessary is context. I think everyone is aware of the fact that we were commissioning the helium side of the plant. That's the first thing. The second thing is, we've been very transparent with regards to the challenges that we'd faced during the commissioning of the helium. So the numbers that you see over there are reflective of a plant that is that from a cost-based perspective is operating as though it were in full operation mode. But during the commissioning phase, we weren't generating revenue from the helium side. And so you've got a skewed perception of what the actual reality is, because if you think about what you're doing, you're running compressors, you're running equipment for the helium side of it, but you're doing that while you're actually getting the equipment to the point where you've completed the construction and the commissioning. It just is what it is. It's the way that you handle the commissioning of any new equipment. But You know, we're fairly confident now that this period is behind us and we've got the entire plant operating.
Mm. One of those big concerns that was there was that cold box, and you needed to bring in some specialists to fix the cold box for the helium. Now that everything's been fixed and tested, when are we expecting helium sales to start?
So the cold box is in liquefaction. We're busy currently preparing multiple storage units. Sales of helium is unfortunately that's under NDA, and our customer isn't too comfortable with the market knowing as and when helium is being shipped to and when. It is quite a secretive market, so I can't give you any forecasts on that. But we will be able to announce after the delivery of the container has taken place.
Stefano, let's take a look at the LNG business. LNG tonnages coming through at 2,388 odd tons, a little higher, almost identical to what it was in the prior period in terms of the production side of things there. What does demand look like there, and what does the order book look like? Is there a bankable order book that's confirmed at this stage?
All of the LNG that we have has been pre-contracted. So 100% of LNG production is all forward sold.
And the rest of the order book that you haven't yet produced, is there orders that are waiting to be fulfilled?
That's exactly what I mean. So all of the LNG from the plant, as the plant starts to ramp up to nameplate capacity, all of the LNG that this plant will produce is already contracted.
Okay. Stefano, do you have an indication of the output, the maximum output, once everything is operational in an ideal kind of scenario for either the LNG side and the helium side? Just what expectation can be in an ideal world? Obviously, there will be challenges. The business might have breakdowns and all of that, but do you have an idea of what it'll look like?
Yeah, no, listen, absolutely. So the nameplate capacity on the plant would see us producing between 50 and 55 tons of LNG per day. And in terms of helium, it produces 75,000 standard cubic feet of liquid helium per day. Those are the headline nameplate output numbers. So at the moment, the tonnages are we're probably about 35 to 40% and starting the ramp-up process.
Mm. Stefano, I want to look at some of the other interesting developments that have been taking place. There is an ongoing dispute with the Solar Group around some land issues. Can you just shed some light on that?
Yes. So, and look, I'm going to be relatively Spartan with regards to what I can and can't share, simply by virtue of the fact that it is a dispute. So I don't want to prejudice either party's positions. But the nub of the matter is that there's a farm in question where a solar development has commenced construction, and we have a petroleum production right with areas in that land where there are potential drilling targets, and on that basis the dispute is around us being able to access those drilling areas.
Mm-hmm. Stefano, without commenting on the details of the dispute, can you shed some light on how much of the land, in terms of land area and possible reserves, are affected or could be affected?
So with respect to the total acreage on their land, the drilling targets, if you just take a look at the square area of the drilling targets that we have relative to the area that they're building, it's about 10% of the land in question that they're sitting on. But obviously it's in quite strategically located pieces of the land where the drilling would take place. And therein lies the nub. With regards to the acreage relative to our field, it's no secret that we've got quite a large parcel of land with regards to our petroleum production right, but you know, this is in a very important area for us, so you know, we've just got to follow the natural process with regards to how we reach a how we reach an agreement between the parties.
Another important area for the Renogen business is that US listing. There was some subscription updates on the debentures that were taken up as part of the fundraising efforts there. Can you shed some light on where we stand with the US listing, when we can expect it to take place, and are we kind of back on track there?
So far so good. Everything is proceeding well. The key thing for us now is finalizing the a private submission to the SEC. So, like in South Africa, we've got the JSE and the regulatory authorities. The SEC is the regulator in the US, and the SEC oversees the document that you use for your prospectus. There is a private filing that goes in, and that private filing can be prepared once the once this set of financials has been made PCAOB compliant, which is a US term. And then we can make the submission and move it to the next step. We're hopeful and optimistic that this is probably the last private submission before we can then switch it over into a public submission. And then from there, we'll get to the sharp end of the stick on the IPO process.
Stefano, what does that mean for timelines? Are we pushing this back to Q2 next year, Q3, Q4? Understanding, of course, that some of the stuff would be subject to when the SEC does their part. But what does a timeline idea kind of look like for when we can expect IPO?
So the timeline on the IPO. IPO is not currently on the critical path. The important thing for us is that when it comes to forecasting this, one needs to remember that, as you rightly point out, the tricky part to forecast is the regulatory side of it. So far, the SEC has been very good. They've been very responsive, and their comments have been very well thought out. So a lot of that timing, it's all completely dependent on when the SEC gives us the final go-ahead. From a market perspective, I think once we've got the clarity from timing on the SEC, we'd then be able to put very very concrete timelines down for everyone. But for now, that's difficult to predict until we've got the final clarity from the SEC.
Stefano, let's wrap things up with a look at some investor and shareholder numbers. No dividend was declared here. Obviously, with the operational standpoint of the business, you'd want to be more revenue generating, I suppose. Take us through the next couple of months. What are the expectations here? How much more resources are you expecting to burn through before revenues start to hit peak levels? Give us an idea of where the business stands.
So where we stand at the moment is we're in the process of now ramping up the operations from the current production levels, and that's an ongoing process. So it's a function of tying in additional wells and connecting in additional kilometers of pipeline. Obviously, once we then hit nameplate capacity, then the income statement looks completely different. It's a completely different kettle of fish. So we're optimistic. We've got our internal timelines. We're working towards those, and we're fairly confident that we're going to be achieving those. Commenting and putting anything down in the public would be deemed to be a forecast. I'm going to avoid giving any forecasts without them having been audited first. But suffice it to say, we're so far on track with our internal projections, and the team is doing a really great job at working towards achieving those projections.
Well, I suppose we can do nothing but wait and see when those numbers do come out. We'll certainly look to catch up as those numbers are made public. For now, we'll leave it at that. Thanks so much, Stefano. Stefano Morani, who is CEO of Renogen, on their update for the first 6 months of the year and where they are forecasted going forward.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, while we were all debating the midterm budget policy statement yesterday and discussing it and trying to make sense of it, there was some even more interesting data that came out yesterday from the guys at 27.4. They gave us their DEI index framework. They launched this yesterday. They gave us an indication of what the index looks to cover. It measures diversity, equity and inclusion in the asset management space and in the asset management sector. And some interesting insights came out of that. And I'm joined on the line now by the portfolio manager at 27Four, who's also responsible for diversity, equity and inclusion at the firm, Akona Mlamleli, to take a look at this and try and make sense of the data. Akona, good evening. Lovely to speak to you again. Of the 8.4 trillion rand of assets under management across the companies you guys measured in this index, only 18% of the CEOs and 18% of the CIOs are women. This is a serious problem.
No, definitely, Jimmy. So 27Four has been running a research, particularly a survey in the last 15 to 16 years. However, that was primarily focused on tracking the transformation of South African asset management industry since 2009. So this year, we actually flipped the survey and decided to introduce the first diversity, equity and inclusion survey in South Africa, and also just broadening up the landscape, not just focusing on transformed asset managers, but the whole landscape within the South African asset management industry. And unfortunately, the numbers don't fare well, particularly on the gender side, as you've indicated, of the assets under management that the South African asset managers do manage. Female participation, particularly at the investment management sphere, continues to be dire, particularly on positions such as portfolio management. However, we are seeing significant improvements in positions such as investment analysts.
Now, Akona, when we look at the index, it measures a couple of things: diversity, equity and inclusion. When we look at the equity side of it, there have been some improvements there with regards to ownership and transformation in that space. What are the numbers saying in that respect?
Yeah, so with regard to the diversity and equity inclusion that we introduced this year into our survey, so it covers five key pillars, the first pillar being ownership. So this ensures that the historically disadvantaged, marginalized groups within South Africa have a meaningful play within the economic stake and the sector in which they currently operate in, particularly the asset management industry. The second pillar is representation, which is focused mostly on leadership, diversity, and just also evaluating the presence of Black people and women in key positions, including the board, directors, the C-suite, and also the key investment professionals within the teams. And the third pillar being equity, which this particular criteria promotes equal comparison in terms of career progression and also retention and hiring of Black people, but also women, just trying to foster an environment where all employees have equal opportunities to succeed, but also thrive. And then the last two pillars, just covering impact, and most importantly, the last pillar being policies and governance. So these five pillars all weigh quite differently, particularly the Black people and the Black women weighed about 40% in the index scoring, and policies and governance weighing up approximately 20%. So this is a combination of a lot of just indications and framework that we have used just to take a deep dive into towards some of the numbers, and in trying to find out where women are less represented, be it in the investment professionals side or in the C-suite side.
Akona, what would you say is the reason why we're seeing transformation or inclusion take so long? I mean, the asset management space has been around for quite some time. We've been in a new democratic dispensation for quite some time. Why is transformation and inclusion and equity still taking so long in this particular sector?
Yeah, so Jimmy, I think when we started the survey in 2019, particularly focusing on transformation, we could count the number of Black asset managers at the time of 2019. However, that has progressed in the last 15 to 16 years, where we have seen transformation taking some time, but also filtering through, particularly to the retirement funds and pension funds where members' assets are managed. However, in compiling the transformation survey over the last 15 to 16 years, what we noticed, and particularly why it drove us to do this DEI index initiative and survey, was that even the transformed asset managers, unfortunately, when it comes to gender parity, particularly across the investment teams, unfortunately have not fared quite well. In answering your question, Jimmy, I think there's a number of phenomena. And I think there's quite a lot of partnerships that are taking place at the moment. But I know a number of investment analysts that do come through the ranks. There are quite a few females that we do see. However, we don't see them progress to the next sphere in terms of portfolio management. And one of them has to be what we all talk about quite frequently, being the culture. And that is the culture within the firm that these women that work under these asset management firms, is it an enabling environment where they're able to progress? We do understand women particularly previously want to have families, many don't, but we also need to take into consideration those factors of wanting to try and balance, although the balance can never be perfect, in trying to create an enabling environment for women to be able to, yes, have children, have families, but also thrive in their career, particularly in these fields. But we found a lot of these firms, unfortunately, have not created these cultures and have not created structures, particularly the smaller and medium asset managers, to provide women with these enabling tools that they can obviously move on to higher positions within the C-suite level. However, we have seen, yes, the numbers are dire, Jimmy, but we have seen a number of the big firms providing enabling environments. And we did hold awards, particularly recognizing firms that are making inroads and are very much driving significant culture and diversity, equity, and inclusion within their firms. So a big firm that was one of the recipients of our awards, with being assets of under management of greater than 100 billion rand, was the Old Mutual Investment Group.
Speaking of firms that are doing their part to empower this, I know this because I happen to know you and Fatima and the 27-4 team. You guys have been hard at work as part of those firms, and I think it's important to recognize the work that you guys do. I'm thinking about the partnership that you guys have with USAID. You touched on partnerships earlier, Akona, and I want to get to the importance of collaboration and perhaps having these conversations more openly to empower not just women in the asset management space, but generally the other pillars of the DEI program as well.
No, correct, Jimmy. I think there's a number of initiatives that are taking place, particularly within the asset management industry. Just talking about 27-4, so we currently have started a Fund Her Forward, which tries to help female private equity managers in terms of raising assets or raising funds or fundraising, particularly for their respective funds. So that has been an initiative that we have partnered up with USAID that took place towards the tail end of last year, and in which yesterday when we did launch the survey where the five women private equity firms actually did attend, and some of the initiatives that are taking place and will be taking place, particularly with those five private equity women. But in terms of partnerships, I think one of the partnerships that has taken place within the asset management industry has been the likes of the CFA. So CFA having an initiative particularly targeting girls, Take a Girl Child to Work. So that has been an initiative that has been taken off by the CFA, where they place a number of girls from disadvantaged communities or disadvantaged schools and take them to asset managers that are listed here in our survey, Jimmy, and just broadening up and helping these young girls in terms of just instilling just a confidence in them, but also what are the options that are available, particularly in their career choices and the possibilities that are available to them. But I think another partnership that I would like to mention has been the one with BlackRock. So in the last 16 years of doing the survey, we noticed particularly in the transformed asset management space where a number of Black asset managers' skills was very much limited to South African asset classes. So we did a partnership with BlackRock and APSIP, the Association of Black Securities Investment Professionals, where we send two investment transformed asset managers to global offices in BlackRock, where they attend sessions for about a week. So partnerships are very pivotal, particularly in this drive for not only for transformation, but also in our journey within DEI.
The asset management space certainly has got some work to do to get it more inclusive, but it does look like we are making progress. I think we'll leave it at that. Akona, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Akona Mlamleli, who is a portfolio manager at 27-4, but she also heads up the DEI program at the asset manager.
The more time you give yourself to save for retirement, the bigger the reward at the end. Don't waste your head start. Start investing now and choose the future you deserve. 91. Investing for a world of change. 91 is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
I happened to be scrolling through X on one particular day and I came across a very, very disturbing video that I had to watch all the way through from someone in South Africa that said that they had recently been the victim of a phone theft that then resulted in a hacking that then resulted in them losing a significant amount of money. And that brought about a lot of concerns around cybersecurity, particularly given that we now live in an age where our lives are almost exclusively on our mobile devices, in our back pockets, at the touch of a finger, quite literally. And it brings about a lot of questions around safety and protection of your data and information. But more than that, I mean, if we look at some of the trends that we've been seeing where people have been unfortunately kidnapped and held hostage and had their bank accounts emptied and all sorts of things like that, I thought we might take a look at cybersecurity, particularly in a mobile context, and how we can protect ourselves in that respect. I'm joined on the line by the solutions architect for the Middle East and Africa at Trend Micro, Zahir Ibrahim, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Zahir. Thanks so much for taking the time. Clearly, now that everybody has the convenience of mobile, we underestimated, I think, as a population, as a global population, just how dangerous that can be.
Good evening, Jimmy, and thanks for having me on your show tonight. No, definitely. I think we definitely underestimated how much data we're actually processing on our mobile devices, especially from a business perspective as well as a personal life perspective. And I think you're rightfully in saying that that video has struck a lot of alarm bells, especially within the private sector, to be able to understand that I, as a personal person, are putting a lot of corporate information on my mobile devices. So quite appropriately, we are processing a lot of data. Like I always like to say in my podcast and my meetings that I chat with my customers, data is the new oil, and the amount of data that we're processing on our mobile devices is quite alarming.
Mm-hmm. For anyone that hasn't seen the video I was referring to is the video of a very painful experience that Sashi Naidu recently experienced. And when I saw the video, Zahir, I looked at it and, I mean, the logical thing there is that you would have security measures in place. I can imagine she would have had biometrics in place, facial recognition, all sorts of things, passwords and all of that in place. How is it that with all of those security measures in place, people can still just get into your devices?
No, definitely. So on this specific case, it's a bit difficult for me to comment because I wasn't quite close to the individual to be able to understand what type of protection method she actually had on a mobile device. But when we're talking in general, you're quite right in saying that a lot of our devices already have biometric authentication on it. It already has facial recognition and also things like PIN code requests or even a signature that needs to be enabled before we're allowed into the device. But to be able to protect ourselves one step further, I think one of the big things that a lot of individuals forget to enable is something that we refer to as MFA. MFA stands for short, which means multi-factor authentication. When we talk about multi-factor authentication, that means all of our apps, whether we're using Facebook, Instagram, Gmail, anything that we have on our device, we need to now enable multi-factor authentication. And what multi-factor authentication means is even if you're using your device to log into something, you still need to provide a secondary authentication method, and that could be some push type of notification, could be an SMS or something like that. So although phones have built-in security measures, it's always good to have a second step as multi-factor on those devices as well.
Well, I suppose with the multi-factor, there's always the debate of how much of it becomes an inconvenience. But if your phone is taken in its entirety, a lot of us have the multi-factor authentication on the very same device. So that kind of doesn't really solve the problem. But let's look at the steps that you can put in place, Zahir. What are the typical flags to look out for? I mean, I'm thinking about the the security measures, right? You have a PIN, you have a password, you can put your fingerprint on there, people can kind of get through the fingerprint thing. And I had a very interesting chat with my producer around the facial recognition, as to how someone would hack the facial recognition. But then she mentioned something very interesting, that with the advancement in artificial intelligence, people can now take a still photo of you, get it to be a moving photo, and suddenly we have a photo of you that could potentially pass biometric verification. What are some of the things that we need to be aware of that will tip us off on, okay, this is probably not going to be a good security measure?
No, 100%. And I think with the advancement of things like AI or artificial intelligence can always be used for good or it can be used for bad. So we got things like ChatGPT, a lot of us are using it. That is a good method to be able to use AI. But then when we're looking at the bad side of AI, and you're right in saying that people can use it to create videos, create pictures of me to be able to bypass the biometrics screen locks. And what that means is something we refer to as deep fakes. And deep fakes are mimicking us as human beings and then using our data to be able to fake our way into an organization. So what I would look at is to be able to ensure that our devices have some sort of deep fake detection to be able to detect some of these capabilities. So from a mobile enterprise perspective, a lot of enterprise solutions will be able to provide deepfake detections for our organizations. But when we're looking at it from a personal perspective, what we need to look out to see if our devices are actually compromised, understand if the batteries are draining fast, is there any weird apps that have been installed or weird pop-ups on our devices. Once we understand some of this is happening on our device, we need to ensure that our devices have strong biometrics, strong passwords. So a password like 1234 is not appropriate. We need to ensure that our passwords are secured. And one thing that a lot of people forget about is regular software updates. Remember, an update is released for performance, but it's also released for fixing vulnerabilities on the specific application. So always ensure that your device is kept up to date.
Zahir, how else can we kind of protect ourselves, understanding that for some people, they run businesses off of their mobile devices and you've got business bank accounts and all sorts of other things in place there. Are there apps we can put in place to detect things? I'm thinking about a computer scenario because it's the closest example. And with computers, we have things like antivirus softwares and all of that. And we kind of have those in mobile, in the mobile spaces, but they're not very popular.
Yeah. So when we're looking at how are we running our businesses today, and we understand that from an enterprise perspective, our work laptop has antivirus, it has all the security controls built into it. But when we're going to the mobile, we forget that our mobile is our extension of our work PC. We got our work emails on there, we got work profiles, we got all of that data that lives from an enterprise perspective. So what I suggest for a lot of businesses is to be able to deploy a mobile enterprise security solution. What does mobile enterprise security solution will be able to do? It could do a couple of things. And one of the key features of the specific solution is then to be able to segment the work profile compared to the personal profile. So anything that is corporate related lives in its own container, while anything that is private related lives on a personal container. So there's no mixture of data between the two. So I think it's very important to be able to download the software from an enterprise perspective and roll it out. From a personal perspective, there is a number of different security tools. Even our banking providers, our financial providers have free banking security apps for our mobile devices to be able to install it from a mobile antivirus point of view and have us secure our antivirus on our devices and protect our identities as well.
So here, with the advancement in technology that we've seen up to this point, surely we can put in place measures to recover things. I'm thinking about, I mean, a lot of the crimes that have been perpetrated in the past, people have been saying we will pay out in Bitcoin, or they convert the money to things like Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies and all that. But we've got technological advancements that suggest that we should be able to track where the money then goes to. How do we recover the money or monies if we've had these things happen to us? And for many people, whether you are running a business, whether it's your personal funds, those funds are critical to expenses you have to pay, to staff you have to pay, to ongoing things. You can't afford to not have that money. How do we recover it if it's been stolen?
So one of the things that I'm seeing a big uptake in, not only globally, but especially from a South Africa and Africa perspective, what we're seeing is a lot of organizations are now taking out cyber insurance. And when we talk about cyber insurance, we need to be able to ensure that we're covered for things like ransomware that will then be able to decrypt our information or provide the money to be able to pay them out. When we start talking about paying ransom, which is always not advisable to be able to pay the ransom, we first resort to things like our backups and make sure that our data is secured and it's quite interrogated before we restore those backups to production. When we're talking about tracing this money, it's a very difficult find. And the reason these bad actors use things like Bitcoin to be able to process the money, it's a very difficult combination to trace the money because the Bitcoin is built on blockchain. The blockchain is then split up amongst multiple servers globally, and then the IP addresses and all of the details that are associated with this Bitcoin transaction is then masked from the naked eye. So it becomes very difficult to trace the money. There have been organizations that will assist, and this is where you start looking at police agencies like Interpol, etc., to be able to assist in tracing these Bitcoin transactions, and hopefully we can then restore the money. But from a business perspective, always make sure that your backups are secure so we can restore from there and make sure that you have a proper disaster recovery plan in place to be resilient when you're restoring the data in your organization.
Folks, now's the time to be exceptionally paranoid about your personal data. Put in place passwords, write things down, put everything in place that you can, because at the rate at which technology is developing, we're all at risk. I think we'll leave it at that. Zahir, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Zahir Ibrahim, Solutions Architect for the Middle East and Africa regions at Trend Micro, joining us to take a look at how you can better protect your mobile devices from being hacked and stolen. Ready to take control of your financial future? Moneyversity Plus is your go-to streaming edutainment platform for all ages. With fun, engaging content and downloads for kids ages 6 to 17 and practical lessons for adults of all ages, Moneyversity Plus makes learning about money easy and exciting for everyone in the family. Plus, as you learn, you can earn Old Mutual Rewards points, a win for your wallet and a win for your future. Whether it's mastering money basics or planning your financial goals, Moneyversity has you covered. Start streaming today and join thousands of others at moneyversity.co.za, your plus one for financial wisdom. It's once again time for another SME, and this week we're taking a look at a company called XTLS Dreadlock Specialist. I'm joined by the company's founder, Xolani Nombenu, to take a look at the business and get a bit of a better understanding of what it is that they do. Good evening, Xolani. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about XTLS Dreadlocks. What do you guys do?
Oh, thank you to the viewers. Okay, at XTLS Dreadlocks, we are the premium dreadlock specialist. We specialize in dreadlocks. We start, grow, and maintain dreadlocks. We also convert relaxers to dreadlocks. Our work, we focus on the overall health of the scalp and the hair. So we also do scalp treatments and hair treatments. We detoxify dreadlocks, especially for long dreadlocks, because they are too long. So you need something that will detox them from inside, just to clean them. So we do everything dreadlocks.
Xolani, why did you start the business focused on dreadlocks? I imagine you, in starting a hair salon, you could have gone in any particular route you wanted. Why focus on dreadlocks?
I think it started because I've always had love for dreadlocks since from a young age, actually, from primary school. While dreadlocks were not allowed in school, so I used to do them on my hair, and then especially during school holidays. So, and then when I met someone who taught me about hair, I was not into hair exactly, but I wore dreadlocks. So when I met someone who taught me about hair, he was specializing in dreadlocks. I think that's what triggered the focus on dreadlocks, because that was how I was introduced to dreadlocks. And then also, looking at dreadlocks, there's a huge market in dreadlocks, more than in the hair, in the mainstream hair, because there are a lot of salons doing the same thing, like the relaxers and everything. But when you specialize in dreadlocks, there are many opportunities, because there are not many brands which specialize in dreadlocks in South Africa. So that's why the focus on dreadlocks.
Xolani, tell us about the business now. Where do you guys operate? How many salons do you guys have? I see you've got more than one and the business is growing quite well.
Yeah, currently we are focused on KZN. We've got three branches. We've got one branch in Umhlanga, one branch in Morningside and one branch in Seaview. So Umhlanga is in the north of Durban, and then the Morningside one is in the central, Durban Central, and then the Seaview one is in the south of Durban.
And Xolani, in terms of the business's operations, it's obviously been quite a journey growing the business. You guys recently entered the Nedbank Pitch and Polish competition. Tell me about that experience. Tell me about what you guys learned from that and why that was such a good experience for you to grow your business.
Well, Leo, Pitch and Polish was such a learning curve for me because I used to know Race Corp also just while it was based in Durban, in the Durban Central. So that's how I was introduced to Race Corp, and that's how I got information about the Pitch and Polish for Nedbank. That was a great experience. I think the learning before the pitching was so intense that it made you just go deeper with your thoughts when you think about your business. Because we're taught about the marketing, finance, how to scale your business. You see, some things that I learned there, some things that I will never have thought about without going through the Pitch and Polish. But the best thing, it was the pitch, because it was the first time in my life I was pitching to funders. So it taught me a lot about the pitch, and I was happy because I was in the top 16. And then I went through to the top 8. And the applications were so much. When they told us that there were more than 20,000 applications. So I was very lucky, and I'm so happy I was in the top 16. And then you see, there was a sessions that we had with the guiders. The people were guiding us about the pitch. So it was one on one. So you could ask any question about the business. The main thing that I learned it was about scaling, that when you need to scale, you need to have stronger systems that will be able to manage the multi-shops, leading you to be able to franchise your business. So it was a great learning curve, thanks to the Pitch and Polish and the Race Corp team.
Xolani, tell me about the scaling. What's next for the business? What do you want to achieve? What are your hopes and dreams with this business?
Our hopes and dreams with this business is to build it into a franchise model. You see, where we have our own branches specializing in dreadlocks, but also diversify the business to have our own hair product range and then to have our own training center. Because when the business grows, especially if you want to push it into a franchise model, the main thing that you will need mostly, it will be the hair products. So if you produce your own, it will be easy to manage that site. And then also you'll need a lot of labor so that you can be able to go into malls. You understand. So for now, still we are based in Durban. We wish to have branches in Johannesburg North, and then Cape Town around Sea Point, and then just build the business into a franchise model, having about 20 branches just before 2040, because this business can grow further even into Africa. When you look around, there are no professional brands with dreadlocks. Mostly the competition, it's people who are on the streets or side corners, as it is evident in the nation, street corners. So if you can be able to professionalize the business and build a strong system, you'll be able to even run the business continentally, just going through other African countries. But in South Africa, mainly, we want to build this into a franchise model.
Xolani, where do people get hold of you? How do people get a hold of you if they want to come to the stores? Are you guys online? Can people find you on Facebook or any of the social pages?
Yeah, we do. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and then our cell number and WhatsApp. It's 076-727-9212. Can I just repeat it? It's 076-727-9212. And then you can also check us on Google or send us an email address. Our email address is xtlsdeben@gmail.com. xtlsdeben@gmail.com.
There you have it, folks. If you're ever in the KZN area, in the KZN region, and you are looking to get your dreadlocks treated or looked after, or if you're just looking for a hair treatment and a scalp treatment, visit the guys at XTLS, a dreadlock specialist. They're happy to look after you. We wish you the best of luck in your business, Xolani. We wish you all the success in the world, and we hope to see your business grow to that big continental franchising business that you dream of. That was Xolani Nombenu, who is the founder of XTLS Dreadlocks, joining us for this week's SME of the Week. It's gone 7 o'clock. Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. From my side, good night.